to Shattering This. Larry, we were discussing Habakkuk when we were last together on this program, and I'd like to continue to make our way through this prophecy. Yesterday, we actually had the discussion with Glenn, and it was a one of those rare situations where Glenn stayed on through the hour where we would discuss Yahweh's testimony. I thought was probably Glenn's single best day in terms of participating in the program during this this hour. But this is right, as they say, in your wheelhouse, understanding what Yahweh said about Paul. And I want to introduce this as we go through it again with an observation that I was trying to make yesterday and that I think Glenn supported. That this Habakkuk prophecy that we're reviewing is the single most important prophecy in the whole of the Torah prophets and Psalms. There are thousands of prophecies. I think this is the single most important because it influences the most souls. No soul, there is no other prophecy that influences more souls than this. Now, there are prophecies that mean more to you and me as children of the covenant. But we're few by comparison to Christians. And this prophecy influences the soul of every Christian, saying that it's essentially dead. What's your view of that?
Well, actually, my view of it is that, you know, it's an amazing prophecy. It's a prophecy that proves Yahweh's words are true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a rational person would look at this prophecy and say, this is stunning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Yahweh prophesied that a guy who would talk in circles, speaking against circumcision, named Shaul.
Yes.
Who was in Jerusalem at the time of the sacrifice.
Fulfillment
would
of the
create mind. A religion,
mm-hmm.
A house, that's another word for a religion,
mm-hmm.
That many people from all over the planet, different races and places, would adhere to. And by doing so, they would be robbed.
Yeah, and it actually, and I actually identifies that very few times as Yahweh address the goyim, but he says that this particular person is going to speak to the goyim, and
oh yeah,
and that right, and that it even is introduced by saying, listen, I'm going to stand on my original requirements and responsibilities. I'm not going to change. And then it says, so I'm going to be really interested to see what he will say about me. And here's this individual that comes and claims to speak for Yahweh, and yet contradicts his responsibilities, undermines his responsibilities, and contradicts his requirements. And you even have that in it. There is...
Well, that in and of itself, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I showed this to a group of atheists.
Right.
Meant nothing to them.
Well,
they're as irrational as the religious.
Yeah. I would assume that it meant nothing to them because, listen, when you put all of this together and then you go through what was Paul's principal character flaw? Ego. And it begins with he's going to be puffed up with false pride. What was Paul's Achilles heel was that he was sexually perverted and that he was ruthless. He was an enraged individual. That's the next thing. His soul. It's not right. It's not straightforward in him. And what was Paul's principal argument against the Torah? That you should ignore it because it is by faith believing his gospel of grace that you will live. And Yahweh says, no, it's through trust and reliance that you'll be vindicated and live. And it even picks out the fact that his principal argument will be against circumcision, even though he himself will be fascinated with the male genitalia. In other words, he's going to be a homosexual. And, you know, you've got his relationship with Timothy, and his principal argument against the Torah was circumcision. I mean, it has such intimate detail, such specificity about this individual who would influence the world more than anyone who has ever lived. And the only way that an atheist can discount it is to go in with the mindset that I'm going to reject anything that is found in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms because it must be religious if it's in a religious book, and therefore I'm not even going to consider it. That is evidence
well,
that I'm going to reject.
That's their position. That's yes. their position. They didn't even figure the creation account, description of relativity written, you know, more than 3,000 years ago. These things, these are just interpretations.
Yeah. Well, 6 days, 6 days, and you can do the math on the stretching of the microwave radiation from the Big Bang, and you find that it stretched to 10 to the 12th power. You do the math on 15 billion years divided by 10 to the 12th power, and it's 6 24-hour days. And that's not an interpretation, it's straightforward math.
Yeah, these people are as irrational as anything I've ever come across. And
that's my experience with outspoken atheists whose religion is socialist secular humanism. They are absolutely impervious to evidence and reason. They claim to be beings based on evidence and reason, and yet they will reject evidence and reason. The reason, by the way, that your statement is valid, that this prophecy proves that Yahweh's words are trustworthy and reliable, is because the probability of naming an individual as Shaul, who would arise during the fulfillment of the Moed, which was in 33 CE, who would claim to speak for God, who would annul God's responsibilities and requirements, who would use circular reasoning, who would be opposed to circumcision, whose audience as a Jew would be Gentiles, the odds of him getting all of that right and describing the single most influential person who ever lived and describing his character flaws and his sexual orientation, we're one in hundreds of billions to one. You'd have a better chance of just getting lucky by running out in a clear day and expect to be struck by lightning 10 times in a row without a cloud in the sky. This is profound proof for those who are reasonable, for those who are informed, for those who are open-minded, for those who can actually consider things logically. And what it concludes is that everyone who is influenced by Paul will die. No hope of salvation.
Two conversations today that pretty much dealt with this. The other was on a person's page that had friended me, and their thing went by, and it was, of course, the usual Yeshua HaMashiach nonsense, faith, and all this. And her position was that there are two main pillars in the Torah, and one is love, and we should love our Christian brothers and sisters. And I said, so your spiritual brothers and sisters are people that openly oppose the Torah.
Where in the Torah is this pillar of love?
Yeah, no, there is no such pillar. I explained that to her, too. And what I did was posted Dode's opinion on that. Those with divided loyalties who are hypocritical, I hate them and I'm opposed to them. And those are the words of Dode.
Yeah.
You know,
in fact, Yahweh's big issue with the Israel and Hosha was that the Israelites had fallen in love with Baal, the Lord, Satan, religion, the Gentile ways, that they had fallen in love with prostitutes and had forfeited their marriage covenant with Yahweh as a result, and he divorced them because of their love of those things which are religious and political and false.
Well, you know,
so love can't be the pillar because they had plenty of love.
Are just, not going to get to the point where they understand that Yahweh is not a religious deity and he's not going to have any of that mud, speaking of Paul, scraped all over him.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question, then Scott, has a comment here. Is it possible for you to love someone you do not know?
No.
So what good is a pillar that is love if you don't have the prerequisite of coming to know the individual that you're supposed to love?
It's an act in futility. Really.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
What do you, Scott, you wanted to interject?
I was going to say that in order to be my brother, you'd have to be part of my family. In order to be part of the family, you have to be... You have to do some things, and you don't have to have love for a Christian. You don't have to have love for anybody.
No,
your love of Yahweh and His words.
I don't love any Christian preacher. In fact, I despise them. I don't love any politician. I despise them. I don't love any military officer. I despise them. I don't love the Islamic jihadist. I despise them. And I don't love the liar, the murderer, the thief. These are bad people doing bad things. This idea that universal love is a good thing is utter nonsense. It's part of the Pauline mythology. When he described himself as jealous, tells us that love has to be protective to be real. If you don't hate those things that are harmful, then you can't love those who are good. You're making them more vulnerable.
Well, but see, that goes hand in glove with the religious tradition that, you got an angel sitting on one side and a demon sitting on the other, and they're arguing over your soul, you know. Yahweh's not omnipresent.
No.
He doesn't love everybody. There are despicable people out there that it would take a monster to love. Really.
Look at the time of Noah, which was less violent than what we're experiencing today. And Yahweh grieved even over having created humanity and wiped out all but 8 people. So did he love everyone? No, he only loved his
Absolutely.
Children. There were eight of them. Even this comment that Larry had shared with us, where somebody wanted to summarize the Torah in a singular word, that it's pillar of the Torah's love. Actually, it's one line in the Torah, which says you should come to love Yahweh, your God, with all your heart, soul, and might. And it's there in the summation of the Torah, and it's not just pillar of love. It's a love Yahweh. And if you don't put it in the context of love Yahweh and then comprehensively, then it's a waste. It doesn't say and love your fellow man. It doesn't say love evil. It doesn't say love religion. It's love Yahweh. And to love Yahweh, you've got to come to know Him. And if you think that you're loving someone who offered you instructions on life, who offered you testimony, who provided a path for you to engage in a relationship with Him and sacrificed tremendously Himself to facilitate that, that you think that you're loving Him by ignoring it all, by saying, oh, that doesn't matter because if the pillar is love, if I just love, then I'll be okay. That's kind of like saying, if I just believe. Without even knowing what you're believing. Or believing that which is untrue. Or loving an imaginary friend. Because you have no idea who Yahweh is. You don't know what his offering. What he wants. The means to engage in the relationship. The invitations to be with him. You've got no clue. And if you've got no clue, love is nothing but an emotion directed at a object of your own imagination. If you don't hate those things which are deceitful and destructive and misleading, And those who promote things that are destructive and deadly and deceitful and misleading, if you don't hate them, if you don't hate Islam for all of the kidnappings and rapes that it is promoting around the world, for all of the sexual genital mutilation it is perpetrating on Muslim girls, for all the terror that it is inspiring around the world, if you don't hate the religion, you're incapable of love, not genuine love. If you don't hate this mindset in America that is our military that makes us secure, well, it's making us more vulnerable. And you're not really loving those that are being made less secure by those very entities. That's the realization here. So, returning to Chabaouk, Larry has had to step off the line for a moment, and he'll be back with us in a minute. It says, pay attention, he'll be puffed up with false pride. His soul is not right or straightforward in him. He does not consider anything appropriately, and is circuitous in his reasoning. He wanders away by twisting and convoluting the teaching. And with him, nothing is on the level. Boy, that is a perfect depiction of Paul in his letters. So then, through trust and reliance, those who are righteous and vindicated shall live. Now, this is the line that Paul misquoted twice in two different letters. It affirms that it is through trust and reliance, ba emunah, by being firmly established, confirmed and upheld by that which is defendable and steadfast, always truthful and reliable, emunah, that those who are righteous and vindicated, tzedak, who are upright, innocent, and acquitted, shall live. Chaya shall be restored to life, being nurtured and growing. Paul quoted this to try to justify his doctrine, which was salvation through faith. And yet this says exactly the opposite. It says through trust and reliance, by being firmly established and upheld by that which is defendable and steadfast, always truthful and reliable. Paul actually said that the Torah was not reliable, that the Torah was not steadfast, that the Torah was not dependable. Paul's doctrine says exactly the opposite of what this communicates. And he said that it isn't through trust and reliance of that which can be known that leads to righteous vindication, tzedak, but by faith in his gospel of grace. And yet, his gospel of grace wouldn't exist for another 666 years. And Yana was saying, everything that you need to know about me has been communicated. It's knowable, it's understandable, it's dependable, it's steadfast, it's not changing, it's truthful and reliable, and that is the means to vindication. Now think of the time that this was written, 666 years before Paul penned his first letter introducing salvation through faith. And this says, through trust and reliance, those who are righteous and vindicated shall live. Yahweh has already said that He is going to stand on his requirements and responsibilities. There's five requirements for participating in the covenant. Yahweh has responsibilities, five benefits for the covenant, and the responsibility to fulfill and honor the promises made during each of the seven Moed, the Mikra. And so it is through reading his guidance, through reading his teaching in his Torah, that we can come to trust and rely on him, and it is through that process of coming to know, to understand, to trust and rely upon which is that which is dependable and steadfast, truthful and unchanging, that we are vindicated. And that's how we live. We have Tommy on the line who has a question for us. Welcome to the program, Tommy.
How you doing, Yada?
Good.
I just had a a quick question about that. You know, that prophecy, when properly translated, just reveals another characteristic about Yahweh that the religious don't seem to get, and that's that he doesn't hide anything. It's so blatant that this prophecy is about Paul. I was just wondering if you could go into some of the discrepancies that you found with modern translations and versus your translation. Because when you read that in the King James or the New American Standard, and it seems a little more vague, mm-hmm. who you might be talking about. So I was just wondering if you could go into some of the corruptions that you had to get rid of to understand what Yahweh was clearly communicating through this prophet.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, first of all, that Paul wrote of the great mysteries that were revealed to him. Religions have mysteries. Cults have mysteries. They initiate the participants in those mysteries. And Paul claims to have had mysteries revealed to him. Now, he never reveals what those mysteries are, but he talks about the great mysteries of God that were revealed to him. And yet, you are correct. Yahweh, by giving us such a specific warning about a specific individual so many years in advance and so much detail about this, he's laying all of his cards face up on the table. Now, the Torah is all of Yahweh's cards, the whole deck, face up on the table. Here's who I am. Here's what I have done. Here's what I am offering. Here's what I want. Here's how you can benefit from these things. You know, you're playing a game where God has set all of his cards face up on the table. You get to read them, benefit from them, can make the connections between them and capitalize. It is a win-win game for both of us. And yet, Paul was exactly the opposite, you know, secretive and the like. Now, as it relates to the errant translations of this, like you read it in the King James, the King James will talk about Sheol as opposed to Shaul. And, you know, Sir Francis Bacon in creating the King James translation on behalf of King Iams for a political purpose so as to control people desperately has to cling to Romans 13, which tells the people that all governments have been appointed by God. And the entire purpose of the King James Version was to communicate Pauline doctrine loud and clear that Paul wrote that all governments were established by God and that you have to submit to them. That's the reason that King Iams, King James, as he was known at the time, desperately wanted a different translation to convey Pauline doctrine and impose his right to rule on the world, at least on Britain. And so when they would come, come through here and realize that there was no one in the King James camp that spoke or read Hebrew, not one. They were Latin scholars, and they were translating the Latin Vulgate. And when Jerome translated the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms into Latin for his Vulgate, he wasn't a Hebrew scholar either. He was using Greek. And so neither of them had any access to or any knowledge of the underlying text itself. So what you have in the King James is a translation of the Hebrew into Greek, a translation of the Greek into Old Latin, a translation by Jerome into the Latin of his day, 3rd century, 4th century. And then the King James is a revision of 5 or 6 English translations of the Latin. It's so far removed from the Hebrew that there's almost no correlation to it. It's you know, you're familiar with the game, Tommy, of telephone that kids used to play?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, where you know, you get a group of maybe five or six kids in a circle, and you tell the first child in the circle, you whisper something in their ear that's a phrase or a sentence, and you have that person repeat it mouth to ear around the circle, and you see what comes out at the end when the sixth person repeats it, and there's usually no correlation between what was originally said, limited correlation, and what comes out the other end. And every one of those children speaks the same language. Now imagine doing this over the course of Hebrew to Greek to Old Latin to Modern Latin to English, and then revising the English. It's six variations through the course of different languages.
And God intends not to be evil,
Now, and also for the King James. Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. There's no purposeful manipulation by the child where there is by the religious cleric or the political proponent. Purposeful copy edits. Now, the next issue is that when you're dealing with all of this, you're creating a manuscript whereby there isn't even any access to the Hebrew. So even if there were Hebrew scholars, even if they wanted to be accurate, which they didn't want to be, and they had no interest in Hebrew, they were anti-Semitic.
Well, they
the only accurate rendition we have now of the Masoretic is the Codex Leningradus, and the Codex Leningradus dates back to maybe 1300 BCE. Excuse me, CE, 12 to 1300 CE. But the problem is that the Codex Leningradus wasn't published, wasn't accessible until almost 100 years after the King James had been created. And so there was no accurate Masoretic text to look at, and the Dead Sea Scrolls wouldn't be found until 1950. So even if they had the desire to translate the Hebrew accurately, they had no basis to do so. So when you look at it and say, yeah, it's hard to get there from the King James translation, understand that the King James translation was not a translation of the Hebrew. What I'm reading is a translation of the Hebrew. So that's the reason why there is such an enormous disparity between what you would read in a King James and what the words actually say. And you know, one of the things that is the single biggest myth here is this promotion of the idea that God is speaking of Babylon, and that the individual is named Sheol. Well, Sheol is not an individual. Sheol doesn't have a soul. And so it's impossible to come to the Sheol pronunciation of what is Shaul. That's the individual's name, masculine name, an individual that has a soul. So, and by the way, Sheol doesn't have an agenda. It's a place. It doesn't have an agenda. You know, it doesn't have a soul, doesn't have an agenda, doesn't have an attitude. And so there is no rational way to get to the King James or any other English translation, and possibly because, the primary reason is because it's twofold. One is none of them were actually translated from the Hebrew. And number two, most Bibles are promoted by Christian institutions. Do you think a Christian institution is going to correctly convey that the name there is Shaul when their New Testament has the flashing light on the road to Damascus call Paul Shaul?
No. The house of cards would come crumbling down.
That is correct. It would be a dagger to their own heart. And so
when I found out about Paul, and of course this Habakkuk 2 prophecy come after I had already found out about Paul, but this one was so descriptive. I was probably like you. Like, how could we have missed this one?
But yeah, it changed. Go ahead.
I was just saying, to find out about Paul was a relief to most of us that are in the family.
It is. Yeah, it is actually a relief.
Everyone else seems to be doing all they can to hold him up.
Yeah, it scares people to death that are devoutly religious that if they get rid of Paul, because that means that their New Testament is rubbish. Because he's not only half of their New Testament, but he's the only part of the New Testament that they read. And so it's the religion is gone when you get rid of Paul, and you can't have a holy Bible and the inerrant word of God. The whole myth that they cling to crumbles when you have to remove Paul from it. But for those of us who are members of the covenant, who are Torah observant, getting rid of Paul eliminates all of the conflicts. So, and all the conflicts are just immediately gone, and you can just relax and enjoy what Yahweh has to say without ever trying to twist things and justify it to make room for the contradictory position of Paul. So, you know, when you mention how this prophecy makes such a difference, I concur with you that I came to know that Paul was a false prophet based upon just comparing his testimony to Yahweh's testimony, particularly when he claimed that the Torah could not save, and B, that there were two covenants, and that the one memorialized in the Torah was of the flesh and was with Hagar. When he wrote that in Galatians, I came to that and said, you know, there's no way to fix this.
He specifically says the covenant was not with Hagar, you know?
Oh, of course. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's no way to fix this. Paul's testimony and Yahweh's testimony are absolute opposites. You can't fix this. You can't resolve it. You can't justify it unless you're willing to be irrational. And I wasn't willing to be irrational.
As much as he likes Abraham, he wouldn't even have it from Abraham.
That is correct. Absolutely. You are correct. We'll be back after the commercial break. Welcome back to Saturday Miss. I do want to have a couple of announcements here as we go forward. One is that the third hour of the program today is going to be a replay of the first hour of our program. And the reason for that is my son is in town, and we're going to spend the rest of the day together. My primary responsibility is as a father, and secondary as a husband. And so I will prioritize my family. And since my son is out visiting, we're going to spend the day together. I will be taking tomorrow off. And I'm taking tomorrow off because of the fact, again, my son is here, and the university where he is a graduate student is playing in a bowl game. It's that game begins during the time I'd be recording this program, and I have committed that he and I will be watching it together. The third announcement is that for the past 2 months, since late October, I have been negotiating behind the scenes, with Scott's knowledge, by the way, with the general manager of Genesis Communication, to take the show back to its original time slot, which begins at 10 o'clock Eastern, 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific time, and it runs for 2 hours, not three. And I've been doing that for two reasons. One is that I do move between East and West Coast. And at the East Coast, this time slot, which starts at noon and goes to 3, it eats up the entire day. It's not enjoyable to give up the whole day. The whole day you've got to stay there to prepare for the show. And then after the show is over, I mean, what do you got? A couple of hours, 3 hours before dinner. And so because of the timing, and we moved to this timing from the original timing primarily to make it easier to syndicate the show. Talk radio and radio in general has changed so dramatically that most talk radio now is pay for play. And I'm paid nothing for this. I don't sell anything as part of this. That's not an option. So since the syndication is not developing apace, and since almost all of our listenership is online, it makes sense that we do it at a time that's convenient, that I do this at a time that's convenient. So we are going back to the original time, and we're going to do the show for 2 hours. What I have found is that when I cover the news for an hour and then move into to Yahweh's testimony and speak on it for an hour, that it's fun, that it moves by quickly, and that I enjoy the process. And 3 hours becomes work. And so I want to enjoy it, and want to enjoy my life and be productive doing things like continuing to research and write. And so sometime the first or second week of January, we're going to move to the new time slot so that the program will begin at 10 o'clock a.m. Monday through Friday Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific time, and it will run for 2 hours. And this is a request that I've made and that GCN has facilitated, so it is of our choosing to do this.
And right now I'm the one holding it up. it's on me. I got to switch things around, change it. It's probably going to be I'm shooting for the middle of January, that second week there. And then I'm trying to work my schedule to where I can still, be part of the show. So that's what's
holding
me up.
The reason that you came back to producing programs was to be part of this show, and is the reason I stayed with GCN is to continue to do this with you, Scott. So GCN has facilitated the move to the original time slot already. We're just the delay right now is making sure that Scott can work other shows around so that he can continue to produce the show.
Exactly. It's kind of a stickler for me if I don't get to do the show. So,
yes, for both of us. And if Scott was not doing the show, I would move elsewhere because it's there's so much easier ways to produce the same amount of talk radio for a worldwide internet based audience than there is to do it as part of this structure with the commercials. And so that is our plan. We wanted to make sure everybody knew what was upcoming. That is not going to occur, however, as Scott said, until perhaps the middle second week of January is when we expect that to occur. And we appreciate your listening to Shattering Myths. May Yah bless. I'll talk to you in a couple of days.